today we're very lucky to have Andrew Fuller join us for our podcast. And I'm just wondering, Andrew, if you could introduce yourself, please.
Hello, I'm Andrew Fuller. I'm a clinical psychologist who works in the areas really of brains, learning and resilience, and a particular interest in young people and helping them to thrive.
Now, we'll just get straight into the effects of what the COVID-19 pandemic might actually have on our children. So the first question that a lot of parents might be wanting to know is, how do you have a constructive conversation with children and teenagers about what's happening?
So from our past experience, when major shocks occur to society, and I suppose particularly I'm thinking of when terrorist attacks have occurred, what happens is that for lots of young people is that the attack becomes almost generalised in terms of their anxiety. And so I'm often reminded of that villain of the 90s, Freddy Krueger, the guy you just couldn't kill off, but you couldn't kind of see always in his transformations. And in some ways, coronavirus is a little like that. So you get these incredibly strong reactions from young people that you may not necessarily expect. Now, there's a number of aspects, of course, to having a productive conversation with young people. But the first is to sort of understand their understanding of the event. So really trying to basically ask them how they're feeling about it. I mean, everyone's heard about coronavirus, everyone's thinking about it and talking about it, so it's not like you're going to be raising something. So just asking them very simply, these are crazy times and it's appropriate really that we're more worried than we normally would be. What do you think you've been worrying about is a good starting point for any parent or professional.
And so if we're looking at, say, teenagers who may have some understanding about what a virus is, what about young children or children in that sort of 5 to sort of 10 age group, perhaps? Is the conversation different between those two?
Yeah, I think that it's basically, with young kids, it's basically saying it's something around that is a bug, which I know is not medically accurate, but at the same time, it's probably a simple way to explain it. It's a bug that can make people sick, and we need to be very careful so that we look after ourselves and keep ourselves well, because none of us want to get sick. So, of course, at these times, a number of fears happen. And one of the logical ones, particularly for middle childhood and for teenagers, is a fear of death. Now, kids often, particularly from about the age of 7 or 8, start to really question about, will I die and will you die? And that's a normal process, but this accentuates it. And so we end up in my clinical practice having young people come in with all sorts of odd fears that may not necessarily be directly expressing that fear of death, but may be expressing it in different ways. So let me give you a couple of examples. One is that often it becomes an increased clinginess and really a fear of being separate from loved ones. So, and of course, long term, that can cause major school refusal problems if we don't treat it. But also we find nightmares increase. We find also that basically almost weird physical or somaticizing symptoms also occur, that people take their fears and turn them into basically some sort of illness that they don't necessarily have. And it's not feigned, it's basically a conversion of really what they're feeling into a physical form. And so you can get quite bizarre ideas happening for kids. So some kids will develop persistent coughs or vomiting or choking or feeling that their chest is compressed because of panic. And so you see a number of these sorts of kids coming through. And one of the things that it's important just to recognise is that probably they all stem from the same point, unless there was a preceding history, that they're really just around this misunderstanding around the level of risk around this. And so one of the things we have to straighten out is that thinking. But there's no point basically trying to straighten out the thinking unless you can start to help them to kind of understand what they're scared about. And so trying to get them to express that, which can be quite difficult because they have not always a clear angle on that either. So it can take a few conversations before sometimes they start to unveil what they do, what fear about the situation. So generally, I recommend to people when they have a sort of lack of clarity around what's really be troubling a child is to go through that sort of five whys kind of process of, you know, so why are you worried about that? Or what is it that you're worried about with that? Or, and you almost go through that five times with kids. And what you often end up with is a worry that is not at all related to the original worry that they expressed in the first place. And then you go, ah, now I know what I'm dealing with.
Do parents have a responsibility, or do they need to try and tone down their level of anxiety if they are particularly anxious? Does that help the child at all? Or do they pick up that it's a bit fake?
Well, if ever there has been a time where we need to prove that we are all in the care of one another, it is now. And so children, of course, are ultimately in the care of their parents. And you can almost directly relate how well a child will function during these times to the way that basically their parents and adults around them function. So to look at this, we can look back on the research on resilience and think about, well, what are the kind of features of people who go through hard times and function well? And there are three major things. The first aspect is that they look reality fair and square in the eye. So they're not basically shirking it. They're basically talking about that there are probabilities, there are risks, there are things that we need to do. So even with, you know, young children, while we basically don't want to frighten them, at the same time, we don't want them to have a sense that we're not showing them the full picture either, because, of course, their ability to protect themselves is important as well. So we all need to wash our hands. We all need to take care of basically how close we are to people for a time. This is not forever, but it's for a time. And that's true for the adults as well. So it's very easy to spin off into sort of sideways issues of anxiety if you don't do that, or with teenagers, sort of a form of recklessness that we see in young people where they almost sort of cough in the face of one another and make a joke of it as if it's a prank. And so it's important to really go through in a methodical, calm way what's basically the troubles that we're facing. The second aspect of recovery from a dreadful event is to find some meaning in the whole process. Now, nobody chose this. Nobody really likes to be separate from their friends and colleagues and so on. We all like to, we're social animals. We like to be face-to-face and mingle. And so this isn't something that any of us would necessarily choose. However, there is, without trying to gild the lily too much, there is a chance to spend some quality time with one another. There's also a chance really to think about how we can simplify our lives at this stage. So it's not about being, so we need to be grateful for this, there are other people worse off in the world. Platitudes of gratitude just don't work, I think, for kids or people generally. I think we need to be realistic about it and say, but there are things that are advantageous about having to spend this time having forced kind of shut in or locked in times. The third aspect really is ingenuity. Australians particularly have a long history of being ingenious people who provide ways of solving problems. And so in a way, it's a time to start to think about creative projects and to think about, well, okay, how could we solve these issues? And I think what we're going to find, particularly with Easter coming up, is a need for people to celebrate and gather in ways that are virtual. And I think that'll be a very interesting process to watch as people inventively do that. And so it's going through methodically those areas. So to answer your question, Harry, it's really a point of calmly starting to plan. So rather than being reactive, it's about being proactive and saying, what are the things that we can put into place that we know help us all to recover from the shock of this?
And so for people and for children who do have, already might have some mental health issues, and teenagers as well, has this made their condition worse, or is that just a too generalised question, or is it really related to the individual? And I don't know if you've noticed any of your patients, if they've changed because of what's been happening over the last few months.
There's sort of a divergent pathway. So there's some kids that basically turn the amplification of whatever they're dealing with up to 11, really. And So everything becomes ramped up. And that's probably the more common response. But there are also another group of kids who become almost careless and to some extent carefree. So I don't need to basically look after myself. And that's a problem for most clinicians, of course, because some of the standard self-care that people, particularly with illnesses or mental health conditions, have been doing, sometimes that goes out of the window and go, well, there's no point keeping that up. I won't worry too much about my blood sugar levels, or I won't worry too much about my diet at this stage. And so it's really about helping people to realize that we want you to survive this. We want you to get through this. We want you to basically look after yourself. That the aim for all of us is optimal health and optimal functioning. And so kids are just the same, that they will sometimes become so amplified they need to be calmed and dampened down by a calmer adult who can methodically work it through. And by the way, interestingly, as the adult works it through with their child, they find themselves to calm down. It's actually a process that's helpful for them as well. The kids who are denying it, it's important to come back to basically talking about, well, okay, there are realities here that we need to face. And that, again, that steers them back to the staring reality in the face, as I said earlier.
Yes, I think we've all been trying to remind ourselves that the world is not just about the coronavirus. People still have other medical conditions that they do need to take care of. And I'm sure most of my GP colleagues have had to deal with teenagers who are asthmatic, for example, who just don't want to take their medication. And so, yes, this is, I guess, another part of dealing with patients who may not be willing to always listen to what we've got to say. So it does take a bit of time and effort to deal with that.
And children with epilepsy and diabetes as well, I find.
Yes, absolutely. If any other chronic conditions, it's always interesting. I'm sure we've all got at least one of those patients in our group. I now would like to move on to what euphemistically is described as cabin fever. I know you've given us probably some advice already about how to try and deal with that in terms of planning and being calm. I'm just wondering, is there any other advice that you would give people about being locked down for long periods of time together?
Well, I think that it's very helpful for our adults to just imagine for a moment that you were basically in a room, maybe at university or in a workplace, and you were sharing a room with a slightly cantankerous mood swinging roommate who had volatile and erratic work habits. And you decided to take on the task of hopefully, put that in quotation marks, informing them about how to improve their lives. And then think about how well that might work out, because it probably is going to be a disastrous outcome. And the same is true with this sort of locked-in cabin fever process. This isn't the time to really use this occasion to start providing long-winded lectures or life lessons about how important things are. It's a time to come back to caring and love and relationships, not instruction and change. Everyone at the moment, because they are in the first phase of this, which is bewilderment and fear, and we're going to get to different phases as this progresses, shell-shocked, really, and exhausted. And so their capacity to make major changes thoughtfully is very, very limited. And that's true for adults, but it's especially true for kids. And so expecting somehow that your child will be able to take on the wisdom of the ages and in your life lessons is just a fallacy. And so it's important then to, of course, think about how you can set the family routines as regularly as we possibly can to keep a sense of normality. So, okay, things aren't normal, but at the same time, we will do things that basically are rituals that basically keep our family together and linked. Now, in terms of mental health, we know that having family rituals, things that happen pretty regularly, usually once a week, are an incredibly powerful predictor of mental well-being. And so whether it's been a great week or a bad week, to try and do whatever it might be. And these are not necessarily expensive things or time-consuming things. It might be we cook up some popcorn and watch a movie on Friday nights, or we basically get a bit of exercise, or we do have a meal where we all sit around and talk about what we're thinking about, whatever it might be for you and your family. But having some time of the week, which is retained just as it would normally be, is incredibly important. What I find in my research is that kids use those times to sort of hang their memories of their childhoods upon. So we want kids to come out of this feeling, functioning well and feeling positive about their lives. And to do that, we need to make sure that the families are functioning well as well.
Now, let's move on to a time that we really don't talk a lot about, but probably most everyone thinks about, is once we get back to normal, once the lockdown ends and the fear of being infected disappears. Unfortunately, I'd like to be able to look into my crystal ball and say when that's going to be, but not sure anyone knows when that's going to be. But when we do get there, what are we going to see in children and teenagers when we start sending them back to school? Do you think there'll be a lot more school refusal? I know we spoke about it earlier, but what do you see happening?
Now, obviously, I see a group of people who are in psychological need, so I'm not saying this is the general process, but the kids that I see, they're quite liking the online world. They think, okay, well, this is pretty good, really. If I can get most of my work done by lunchtime, the rest of the day is mine just making computer games. So, I can sort of start messaging my friends. And so there are going to be increasing numbers of kids who go, I don't want to go back to school, thank you very much. I'm quite happy with this new system. So if their families are, you know, reasonably okay, they will probably choose a different form of education. And so what we have to contend with here in terms of the education system is ultimately a major change in the way that it occurs for some, but not all kids. So we know currently the current system fails to engage, or about 7% of the school-age population don't attend at all. Now, I predict, and my predictions are always risky, but I predict that's going to increase quite dramatically, that there will be a group of younger people who basically decide to go online for their education or choose to opt out altogether. And our job then is to think about how we make sure that those smart young Australians don't opt out altogether, but they basically start to think about how they can learn and develop their learning strengths and their skills in life. And so that's the challenge ahead of us. There's a lot of group of anxious kids, of course, that find school fairly onerous. There's a group of kids that are on the spectrum who would prefer not to deal with people. There's a lot of introverted kids. And so you can kind of start to tip them off. These are all kids for whom the current situation suits them down to the ground. And I guess while all of us adults that are likely to be listening to this find the current times challenging, it's the young people who are actually the most adapted to basically connecting up, linking up in terms of online worlds. And so they're the ones who are going to adapt most easily to the new circumstances, and a reversion to the past way, for many of them, but not all, just won't work. Now, of course, there are some kids that are just itching to go back to school and see their friends, of course. So I'm not talking about everyone, but there is a significant group, I think, that will basically not return to school in a way that it's been currently envisaged.
So is that necessarily a good or a bad thing?
Well, I'm not sure. To be honest with you, I think there is some potential here. I mean, schools have really been trapped into a kind of, well, I've got a set number of hours, I've got a set number of teachers, and I've got a set number of students, and I need to kind of work that formula so that everyone's preoccupied most of the time. And I think that formula for schools, where it's almost been how do you kind of keep people busy, can change. So there's a great opportunity to be quite inventive about the sorts of really quality education that we can give young people. So this is going to be quite threatening to some people, but it's also a major opportunity. So, for example, we might have a gun, absolutely expert biology teacher, who could presumably beam their class out online to thousands of students rather than just being restricted to the students in his or her classroom, and maybe having that supported by online groups. There's all sorts of possibilities in terms of doing this. And so also there's a lot of downtime in schools, and a lot of kids don't like that downtime. and it's not especially productive. So it's a revisioning of what's possible in terms of education.
So I must say, just as an individual, I'm sort of a bit surprised that we've got about 7% of kids not sort of engaging in the school system. It really does disadvantage them in life if they don't get the basics right.
Well, one of the biggest factors in terms of helping increase the well-being of young people isn't well-being programs, it's making sure that young people feel successful and succeed at school. There's clear evidence that the more time you spend basically developing your academic skills, the better off in terms of personal well-being you're going to be. And that's why it's important, I think, to take the time to really use this opportunity at this stage to build learning strengths, to help families to identify in their kids those learning strengths and then build them up, because otherwise you end up essentially with a group of kids who will become disenfranchised from education.
Do we have any lessons from our rural and remote teachers or from Indigenous teaching?
Yes, we do. So just to add one more thing, they often refer to them as NEETs, not in education or employment or training, NEETs, N-E-E-T. So these are kids that basically just opt out. And I've worked extensively with distance education, schools of the air, and also Indigenous schools. And so we have a number of really interesting models that they use, but those schools are very effective in creating good academic outcomes. And so some of the Indigenous schools have intensives for that kids come from remote areas for a short period of time together, and it becomes an intensive 5 week, and then they go back to their family area, and that works quite well, and that's sporadic over the schools. We have other models where basically people have, again, short bursts of education. So the idea, essentially, that you have to sit in a classroom for, let's say, 40 minutes or 70 minutes or whatever the lesson time is not necessarily the only way to do it. For example, there's quite a body of research that says a model of 8-8-8-8-8 works, so that basically if I was to teach you, Harry, something, a concept for 8 minutes, and then gave you an opportunity to kind of, with a group of peers, process that for 8 minutes, and then I came back and we developed the ideas further, and we did that sort of on three occasions across a 40-minute span with more processing time and less instruction time, the outcomes are very, very good. So here we have an opportunity to kind of reshape what we've been doing in terms of schools. Schools are largely based on what worked largely in sort of 19th century Britain, rather than how brains work. And so this is an opportunity to kind of reshape it.
I'll make this my last question, and you don't have to answer this one. But a lot of GPs who will be listening to this would be thinking about their CPD learning, their continuing professional development education learning. It might be time that we spend a little more time thinking about how we deliver that in an effective way, like the 8-8-8-8 method.
Yes, I think that's right. I think we do often just provide a lecture that goes on and on and on and don't process and deepen our ideas. And so our professional training, I mean, all of us are practitioners at heart. And so while we like the theory and we like the research, nothing really beats processing it with a group of informed colleagues about how we might use this. So, for example, just to give you one quick sort of sideways example, we know that we're going to see inflated numbers of people who are anxious over the next probably few months. And we know basically that while mindfulness processes are useful, they're not a panacea. And so we need then to think about, okay, how do we help people then to manage anxiety? We can use increased levels of medication, and sometimes we will. Sometimes it will be more about fatigue and sleep deprivation. Sometimes it will be about doing about to exercise. Sometimes it'll be teaching them breathing techniques. There's a whole series of ways of helping people to manage anxiety. Unless you really start to process and think about the management of anxiety just in our normal lives, then you end up just basically going back to a couple of stock answers. And that's often not sufficient for the young people that I work with anyway.
And so, Andrew, is there any other advice that you would like to give health professionals?
I think there's a risk for professionals to spend a lot of time at this stage trying to cheer people up. And I think it doesn't really work. While it's nice to be, you know, positive and hopeful, at the same time, we work on the basis of probabilities. And I think it's much more realistic when talking to our patients to basically talk about, well, these are the probabilities. The probability is you will not die from this. The probabilities are you may not even contract it, but the probability is you could transmit it. And so we need to think about how we can limit that to keep people safe. And so it's being realistic rather than being unrealistically cheerful around this. And I think also if we feel compelled to cheer people up, then it can become exhausting for ourselves and we can end up kind of falling apart a bit ourselves. So the self-care for professionals becomes particularly important at this stage.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you for your time. I think there's a lot of very important information about how to deal with each other and our children and our partners. And we look forward to talking to you again at some time.